Welcome to Pod Summarizer, the way to summarize your favorite podcasts. Today, we have a summary of Jay Shetty podcast. In this episode, Novak Djokovic discusses his journey of self-discovery through tennis. Explore the emotional complexities and wellness strategies that drive champions to greatness. And now, let's begin.
The world's number one male tennis player.
He's won 24 Grand Slams.
In a glittering career.
Novak Djokovic.
You've been through so many injuries, losses.
Oh, he's hurt himself.
What has Novak Djokovic done?
What goes through your mind when you lose?
I just want to be left alone.
What has it taken to become Novak Djokovic?
It's a consistent practice. It's prayer work, mindfulness, meditation, conscious breathing. It requires more responsibility from you on a daily basis to prepare yourself for the biggest battle.
When did you first become aware of that feeling of not being enough?
I kind of get emotional about it because it's still deep inside of me.
Do you feel like in your career you've achieved everything you set out to as a tennis player?
When you reach your 30, you start counting your days to your retirement. I'm 38 this year. How far can I go? How long can I push my own limits?
The number one health and wellness podcast.
Jay Shetty.
Jay Shetty.
The one, the only Jay Shetty.
Hey everyone, welcome back to On Purpose, the number one health and wellness podcast in the world. Thanks to each and every one of you who come back every week to listen, learn, and grow. Now, this is an incredible statistic that I'm sharing for the first time. Thanks to you, we are now creating 500 million views every month, not every year, every month. Today, I get to welcome back a guest who has been a big part of making that possible for me. I'm grateful to him. I'm indebted to him because he believed in the mission of On Purpose even before many people did, or any people did. Before this podcast was even out, he allowed me the gracious kindness to go and interview him and release as the second episode of all time. Welcoming back to On Purpose, I'm so excited to have my friend, the incredible human, Novak Djokovic. Novak.
Thank you, Jay.
Do you know what? I'm so grateful to have you back, and my heart is so full because you were one of those rare people that had seen one of my first ever videos. We'd reached out, we'd connected, we were talking a lot at the time. You were going through a really fascinating place in your career. You were recovering from an injury.
Right.
It was a different mindset. You were just on the cusp of becoming the greatest of all time. And you took a chance on me in so many ways. And I'm eternally indebted and grateful to you for that. So thank you for coming on then and coming back now.
Jay, thank you. It's a great pleasure to see you again and to be able to talk to you. Thank you for kind words in introduction and as well. Reflecting on our first conversation in 2019, I don't think I took a chance because we talked about it just before we started officially recording. You know, when you are connected with yourself and with your emotions, and when you feel someone deeply and look in someone's eyes and you understand instantly with your instinct, with your intuition, whether this person thinks good or thinks bad or has the right intention, has the heart at the right place. So I could see that from the first moment with you. And that's where I felt the connection. And even though we haven't seen each other for a few years, you know, I'm just so glad that we're able to connect now. And you led me through the list of all the guests that you had in the last almost 300 episodes in the last 5 years. And I couldn't be happier for you and for your wife and for your entire team. Amazing.
Oh, thank you, man. And it's you gave me my first Wimbledon experience. I got to see you play. On center court.
How was that?
It was amazing. I mean, are you kidding me? It was like, and you crushed, you won, obviously. But it was just such a brilliant experience to see you play after getting to understand your psychology. And I think that's what I've respected about you over time, that you've really worked hard on your internal game as much as your external game. And I think you're one of those few rare athletes that have raised the consciousness by working on your own consciousness. So today I want to dive deep into that. And I want to dive right in. I wanted to start by asking you, like, what has it taken to become Novak Djokovic? Like, what has it actually taken to become you internally?
You know, you mentioned that I took a lot of the time and attention to dedicate myself to the internal work. And, you know, I've been blessed and really lucky in a certain way to be surrounded with certain people at the very early stages of my career and my life that have directed me into this direction of self-care, of holistic approach, of multidisciplinary approach to the preparation, to the prevention, to the recovery, both physical, mental, emotional. And at that time, because I was so young, I didn't understand that. And it didn't need to be explained to me in depth at that point. I trusted, you know, my tennis mother, as I like to call her. She passed away 13 years ago, but she was the one that really introduced this holistic concept to me. You know, I was going, you know, obviously to school, and then I was only 9 years old and 9, 10, and I was training with her maybe 2 or 3 times a week individually, tennis, and then I would have group sessions. And my parents were, you know, were trusting her enough to allow her to participate directly into my upbringing, basically. So she also educated me off the tennis court as well. So she took me very often, at least 2 times per week, to her house, where we would look at the tapes of all the greats, both male and female tennis players. That's where my impersonation started. You know, people, you know, still to this day ask me, you know, when are you going to do the imitations, impersonations? And, you know, I haven't done it. I've done it early in my career and it was fun. It was viral and people liked it. And then I received a little bit of an evil looks in the locker room and I kind of felt like, you know, maybe I'm stepping over the line. So that's why I stopped. But that's where it started. And I was like, I was really trying to adapt all of the great things that I could see. And I have a kind of a photogenic memory and I'm a very visual person. And that was something that was kind of expected, that is kind of common as well, what you do with kids, you know, or with young athletes, right? You watch videotapes, you try to analyze, you try to talk. But then she had me listen to classical music. And she said, it's very important that you do that almost on a daily basis, listen to classical music while you are writing your journal, while you are, you know, preparing for bed or any time of the day, but particularly those times. And, you know, I liked it. I didn't understand the purpose of it, but, you know, I liked it. And so we would look at the tapes and we'd listen to this music and then we would read poetry. And then we would do a visualization practice. At that time, it was not presented to me as such, but she would just say in a very simple way that would be understood by a boy, a 10-year-old boy, just close your eyes and think about how you want to play tennis and think about when you're your happiest. And so it started at a very early age. And I'm so eternally grateful to her for instilling this in me and teaching me, you know, how to see life basically and understand that tennis is not, as an individual sport, of course, is also different because you don't have anyone to replace you if something goes bad, you know, during the match. You have to figure out a way. So I think it requires more responsibility from you on a daily basis to prepare yourself for a biggest battle internally and also externally, of course, with your opponent and with everything that is happening around.
Having navigated the complexities of personal achievement and the shadows of self-doubt, the conversation shifts to the profound impact of upbringing and how it shapes one's journey towards self-acceptance.
But as I said, it's a constant journey and process.
Yeah, I really appreciate you being honest about your experience with your father, because I think that pretty much anyone who goes off to do something successful externally, all of us and everyone was channeling some sort of internal inadequacy or an internal feeling of not being enough, as you said. And I wanted to ask, when did you first become aware of that, that you had that feeling of not being enough?
Right.
And how have you helped that evolve in the healthiest way possible? What has been that journey of almost having to live with it because it's there, but not letting it be your guiding light?
Well, you're right. It makes sense, because I think if you use it as the right fuel, it can actually serve as a great motivating factor, right? It can push you, it can, you know, stimulate you to extract the most amount of necessary energy on a daily basis to achieve your goals and to basically live your dream. I think for me, it started really as something that was inevitable as a part of the environment that I was in. I touched upon that a little bit in our conversation 5-6 years ago, my upbringing with several wars and sanctions and embargo and poverty and everything. So, you know, from a very young age, I was basically forced to mature very quickly because I'm oldest of the three brothers. I have two younger brothers. So as an oldest son to my father, I was basically kind of in a position where I had to be informed very early on, particularly the age of 11, 12, when we had that bombing and the war and sanctions, that state that we are in as a family or as people of my country, the situation, the circumstances, my father had to bring it forward to me in a very clear, mature way. So, you know, one of the most impactful moments of my upbringing and my childhood is when he brought 10 Deutschmarks, and I've said this story many times, which is equivalent to $10. And he said, this is all we got for our family of five, as living in a super small apartment. That's where it hit me. It was like, okay, now I have to take the means in my hands as a 12-year-old boy in whatever way I can. At least what I can do is support my mother, maybe from some of the burden that she has during the day of taking care of my younger brothers. And that's where it also hit me that not having success is not an option. Like, I have to succeed. It's basically a matter of existence, a survival of my family. So I think it started there. And then over the years, it has obviously transformed or evolved into different kind of form. But I think that, and also my relationship with my father, oftentimes because of maybe lack of patience of my father or of people around, because everyone saw that I have a talent. I was coming from Serbia that had no tennis tradition, no tennis culture. We are a nation of a team sports. We are definitely a sporting nation. We love sports, but team sports. And at that point, during 90s, it was about survival. People were watching sports, but there was not much support for the sports. It was particularly not tennis, a very expensive sport at the time. I chose the most difficult sport for my parents in most difficult time for our nation and for my family. So oftentimes I wouldn't travel because we didn't have money. And then, you know, obviously, as you can imagine, Tennis Federation didn't have, you know, money to support me. So my father had to go and beg. And then he was also borrowing money from, unfortunately, even some criminals at the time during 90s. And then they would, you know, they would tell him, it's a funny story right now, but at the time it wasn't funny, particularly for him. But, you know, he would go and he said, first time I was going to go to United States to play. I was 15 years old. I was going to play like big junior events here, like Prince Cup and Orange Bowl. They're the biggest ones under 16 and under 18. And also, more importantly, I was going with my father, hopefully to get the sponsorship or, you know, get recruited by one of the big agencies, IMGs or whatever. So he went for us for money because we didn't have. So he went to ask for $5,000. And so these criminal people that you could borrow money from because banks obviously would not give it to you. And then they said, you know, he asked them, you know, how much are you in rush? And he's like, listen, I'm asking this money from you because of my son. He's playing tennis. We're going in America. You know, I'll return this money within whatever they agreed on, 1 or 2 months, whatever it is, 3 months. He says interest rate was 15%, but because you are in rush, it's 25. So my father was like, okay, you know, I'll take it because I have no other option. So, and I can only imagine the stress that he was going through and trying to return this money where people were really car chasing him, shootings in our capital town, stuff that my father went through, you know, to really not only survive himself, but to actually allow all of us to live and protect us and to allow me to live my dream and to play the most expensive sport at the time for my country is something that I'm eternally indebted. I cannot, there's no money or there's nothing that can return the favor, so to say. So of course, my father's always my hero for that and my champion. But, you know, feeling of not enough because of that stress and what things that he was going through. And then, it was hard because he was giving me also a hard time if I wouldn't play well. And it's like, and then I understood, but at the same time, I was afraid. I knew what I have to do, but you know, it's hard for me to deliver it when you need, it's like, okay, you need to win no matter what type of situation. He wasn't telling me that, but yeah, that's how it felt. And it felt like that for years. So that's why I say that the success that I have achieved is not only due to my father or my parents or myself, it's also the divine higher force. I strongly believe that there was an intervention, and there still is. There's higher forces in power that were helping me in some of the most difficult moments, in my family as well. I am a man of faith, and I really truly believe in God and the higher spiritual force that intervenes in the most difficult moments if you open your heart, if you pray, and if you believe in it. So I felt it on my own skin. Jay, to be honest, I really don't know how I won certain matches. I cannot explain it. Even with my team, after I would finish a Grand Slam final against Roger Federer in 2019, Wimbledon, when he was a far better player, I saved some match points and I came off the court. All stats were going his way. I won the match. And I just said, you know, and I wasn't playing well. I wasn't feeling well on the court. And I was just like struggling and scrambling and trying to stay out there, stay alive. And I won in the end in one of the most epic finals in history of tennis. And then, you know, I told to my parents and my family and my team, I said, and my wife, I said, I don't know how I won this match. I have no idea. At the same time, I do know deep inside that there's that connection happening and that there's also that help. So there's a mix of things. It's really hard to explain. Sometimes there's this divine power that really, if you allow it, if you believe it, that really helps you come out of a trouble and achieve things.
Having navigated the complexities of unexpected victories and divine support, the conversation shifts to the heightened emotional stakes of representing one's country as the athlete reflects on the profound significance of national pride in competition.
Even stronger intensity of emotions that you go through because you're not playing for yourself only in that way. I mean, when I play all the tournaments, I always represent my country, but here in this official team competitions or Olympics, it's even more emphasize the importance of your country, of wearing those colors, you know, on your sleeve or in your heart. So when you lose, you're like, you know, you're so down and the whole world collapsed. I'm very happy that I was able to win the gold medal for my country last year in Paris Olympics, because that was a long time dream of mine. And the Olympic Games are just so special. You know, every 4 years, I know LA is the next one, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
My wish is to be able to play LA. I mean, hopefully I'll be still playing to be able to participate.
Yeah, I hope so too. It'll be fun to be able to just watch you locally for once.
For sure.
And we got the Soccer World Cup coming to America too. So
yeah,
it's an exciting time. But no, I love hearing that as well. Just like when you're playing for yourself, you let yourself down, you let the fans down. But when you're playing for your country, you let the country down. And, you know, no one wants to let their country down. No one wants to, you know, everyone wants to represent well. And I think sometimes at a national level, athletes get it really tough when you lose for your country.
Yes.
It's one of the hardest feelings because, yeah, it's a different emotion. And I think we forget as fans and followers, you forget the human experience.
Aspect, of like, no, for sure. I mean, look, we are very blessed as athletes on the highest level to be able to play the sport that we fell in love with, because if not all, but super majority of professional athletes play those sports on the highest level because when they were kids, they wanted to play tennis, basketball, football, whatever. They fell in love. And it's a love and passion for the game that got you going. So it's important to state that because, you know, we are for sure fortunate ones. But at the same time, we feel that through sport, we are able to connect with people and people are able to connect with the virtues that sport and the values that sport represents that help them in their everyday life. Mm-hmm. I think that's not something that has been talked about a lot.
Yeah, I agree.
On why is it that our sports are so popular? Why is it that people relate to athletes. It's because of this grit, because of this battle. We all go through internal battle on a daily basis. And in sports, we can, of course, admire the features of an athlete and the skills and the talent and the abilities. But at the same time, we also identify ourselves with those athletes. Mm-hmm. We feel like, wow, you know, this game or a match, it's in a way a condensed daily life or a condensed life into an hour or two or three, where you start at the beginning, you're even, then you end up, you know, winning or losing. But in the process or journey of the match and the game, you're going through ups and downs. You're going, and particularly in the individual sports, you're going, you mentioned Lewis Hamilton, another great legend. You're going through that battle of, you know, trying to win that inner battle where you go through your doubts, your worries, your fears. So all of these elements are part of everyday life of everyday person. And that's why I feel like people relate to sport. It is, they feel like all of their problems stop, mm-hmm. at least for those hour, two, 3 hours that they are watching. Mm-hmm. And they feel like they can also, when they're watching, I mean, that's my observation and experience with tennis fans, for example, or I mean, of course, I watch basketball and football live as well, or the other fans of the other sports, is that that's where they feel like they can free themselves of the emotions and the burdens that are kind of wearing them down. And sometimes it really goes to an extreme level where people start really or swearing and fighting and throwing stuff at the athletes and behaving really bad, like hooligans. And that's obviously a part that I don't support. But I can see that there's a lot of people that are like, that's why like after a game, they either feel drained or they feel energized. Mm. They either feel like they've kind of like collected that energy from the stadium, or they feel like they're completely like a deflated balloon because they've, you know, been through crazy intensity of the emotions, and they relate, they follow every point and every second of the game. And then they, in the end, of course, if their team loses, it's a big difference than when they win. But it's just that identification that happens that I feel like it's super strong, and why sports are so important for the society and why people regard it as something very popular and important for them.
And I'm really glad you're having that conversation, because I think it can have, even as a kid, like I grew up playing sport, never, you know, good enough to play at any semi-professional, even professional level, but sport created discipline in my life, even as someone who wasn't, right. you know, that prolific at sport, created discipline, created teamwork. If you were playing a team sport,
right.
created timeliness, created commitment, created yes. showing up. There were so many healthy, valuable masculine
right.
traits as well that were so important. And of course, for women as well. And it's interesting what you say about it going the toxic side, because I think it was the last Euros or the World Cup, and there was this statistic about how domestic violence in England goes up if England lose, but it goes up even more if England win.
Oh, wow.
Because people drink more when they win.
Right.
So, and that's just so shocking that you see that connection too. And that's why I think it's even more important to get these positive messages through sport out exactly. so that we don't have that kind of a statistic, because, and that's specifically to do with football, soccer.
Yes, of course. But no, it is a super important. Yeah. And I think, but in football, it's far more extreme than in tennis in terms of the
tennis fans
ultra,
are a bit
ultra
more,
fans and, yeah. and you know, the kind of like following and being such an ultra devoted fan. I mean, they literally live for that the entire year, which I think it's beautiful when you see choreographies of some fans in the basketball games or football games, and it's art, it's beautiful, you know. And then this energy when thousands and tens of thousands of people start singing together for their club. I mean, it's incredible feeling.
Having celebrated the vibrant energy of sports fandom, the conversation shifts to the personal journeys of athletes, exploring the emotional challenges they face during transitions and the importance of mental preparation.
Players, established tennis players who were retired and shared their experience of post-career with me, but also other athletes, and how, you know, the struggles they had mentally, and particularly the struggles that they had if they have not prepared themselves for that transition. I believe that in some way you cannot fully prepare yourself for that transition mentally. Like, it's going to be a sad day for me when I leave tennis, and it's going to be very emotional, and I know that. But what I'm talking about is basically the adrenaline that also needs to be filtered or rechanneled somewhere. And I know that I will play sports for the rest of my life because I love sports and being active is essential. But also I feel like you need a challenge. Tennis has consumed most of my life, and that's what I know how to do best. But I have very broad interest in a lot of different things, and the industry or the sphere of life, which is called health, wellness, and well-being, is my biggest passion. And it's very broad ecosystem or field, if you want, as you know, because you're part of it. But it has been my passion for 15 plus years. And, you know, always imagined the world where most of the people will take care of themselves, of, you know, how they hydrate, how they eat, exercise, how they manage their sleep, just the healthier world. And of course, it's hard to change everything at the same time. And it, of course, takes a lot of different time because this, the planet is big and there's a lot of people. But I think taking small steps is very valuable and it has its effect. So hydration is something that was always super important for me as a professional athlete. And I noticed that people who live everyday life, but not only them, but also athletes, don't really understand the importance of hydration and don't really understand maybe how to fully hydrate themselves on a cellular level. Because when we talk about hydration, obviously, first thing that comes to your mind is drink water, right? We drink water, we have to, we wouldn't survive a day without water. So that's normal. But then we also have all these other ingredients and vitamins and minerals and things that we're trying to take, whether it's through supplementation, whether it's through food. Obviously, if you can get everything through food, it's the best. Brian Johnson, I saw the other day, 100 and whatever tablets that he's taking. Yeah. I mean, it's, I don't know how he does it. I mean, amazing, but I don't think I would be able to drink, and I don't want to drink that many tablets. I do have supplementation myself, but I prefer trying to take everything through food. But it's difficult because our soil is depleted. The food that we are getting is most of the time comes from the other remote side of the world, travels, lost its nutrients, you know, and it's hard. You know, we have a polluted air, polluted water, polluted soil, all of these things, you know, play an important role in the inflammatory processes in our body or how we ingest certain ingredients and substances that are necessary for optimal health. So going back to the hydration, I think hydration is probably the easiest step towards that healthier diet or healthier life. And it's something that we cannot go without on a daily basis, and something that is easy as breathing. That's something that everybody can do. Diet changes are something that is more challenging, I think, for people. And there are hundreds of different diets, and I don't want to get into it because everyone has their preference. But I think hydration is probably something that we will all agree with. So since 2017 or 18, I've been working on this project, and I've been thinking, you know, and I didn't want to come out. I could have come out. I've worked with a few different people, and I finally then agreed to come out on the market with, it's basically a wellness brand called Sila. And one of the, well, the first product that we come out with is hydration, but we have magnesium. We are working on our sleep formula, nootropic formula, gut formula. So we're going to have a line of different products. And I'm doing that. I used to play tennis and we know each other since we were teenagers, and very, very passionate guy about, you know, wellness and hydration and healthy lifestyle. So I found that we are very synergetic in our mission and vision. And he had something similar in his life that he wanted to do. And he said, let's join forces and do it together. So we just recently started.
Amazing.
We're very quietly, kind of as a soft launch, because I don't want this product or this brand to be just one of the many, many out there. And when I say that, I mean that every ingredient that is in every of the product needs to be 100% best quality that is out there. But, you know, I'm very passionate about this because it's a kind of a continuation of my passion, of my story, of my journey. It's what I love. It's what I drink on a daily basis. My kids drink it, my wife, everybody. And so I'm always looking for new ways or best supplements or things that can improve my performance. They can improve my performance, not just on the tennis court, but also in life, for me to have more clarity, more energy, better sleep and stuff like this. So I decided to do something on my own because the supplements out there that I was trying, there are some good ones, but I was not fully satisfied. So I try to kind of take the means in my hands and control the process from A to Z. It's the way I am. It's how I do things. And so hopefully people will like it. I don't know. You know, it's going to be interesting journey that we're embarking on. And other than that, I have another very interesting project. It's called Regenesis Pod that I want to get you in that pod. It's been also 6 years that we're working on that and we're launching later this year.
Amen.
And that pod is like a capsule, you know, like one of those sleeping capsules that you have in an airport. Mm-hmm. So about 12, 13 years ago, I was in Dubai airport and I was in business class lounge and I was like, look at me, you know, I'm so, you know, lucky to be here and to be able to have a bed or have this, you know, sleeping pod or something like that. But, you know, 99% of the people, I mean, they're on layovers, they're in transit, they're sleeping on the floor in uncomfortable chairs and stuff. So felt like how cool would it be if, you know, on the airport, we would have these pods where
I love that.
People will go in and out, not only to nap and sleep, but to go in and out in shortest amount of time, whether it's, you know, 8, 10, 15, 20 minutes, and feel refreshed and feel re-energized. They can reset their system and recharge the batteries and go on with their day. And by that time, I was already traveling with an additional suitcase of gadgets, of near-infrared, far-infrared, pulse electromagnetic frequency, different plates, boards, you name it. I mean, essential oils, this, that, light therapies, vibrational frequencies, sounds, everything. Everything that is out there in the market that I find amusing and interesting, I take it, I try it, I try to implement it. So I'm still traveling with these gadgets. And so I said, okay, so we connected and then he had also some similar thoughts.
That's it for today. Got a podcast? Head over to podsummarizer.xyz and start summarizing it in seconds. See you there.